This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9, your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self. Andrew the Apprentice and James Finlay are with you. It is Mental Health Week.
That's right.
And so we're discussing mental health with two professionals in the area.
A clinical psychologist and a general practitioner.
That's right. Dr. Bing, Dr. Glenn.
Hello.
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 We should have our own double act. Really.
So, Bing, starting with you, you're a general practitioner.
Yes.
And so, how often, in a typical day, how often are you confronted with mental health conditions of patients?
A lot, actually. Mental health issues form a big part of general practice. Either, you know, as a direct presentation, they come in for mental health issues, or it's related to what they're presenting with. So it's something we see a lot of every single day.
Is it something that has been increasing over the past few years? Because of awareness and people actually realizing that they might need to talk about something?
It's actually, yes, you're probably right. I think people are seeking help more often now, which is a good thing. Mm. And also a few years ago when the government introduced the Medicare rebates for mental from psychologists, it made a big difference to people presenting, because at least they had options then to go see a psychologist. So I think people are presenting more often, which is a good thing.
Okay. And Dr. Glenn, you are a clinical psychologist, seeing people all through the day.
Yep.
And How often do you, we'll keep it to gay men or MSM, men have sex with men, does sexual health come up in conversation?
Okay, well, I wouldn't say it's something that comes up all of the time, but of course what we do know is that sexual health and sexuality and sex plays a huge part in everyone's functioning, and also in everyone's dysfunctioning. So often if there are problems with anxiety, with mood in relationships, inevitably that's going to manifest in the sex life as well. So it does have an impact.
Now, we've been seeing a lot of different things happen with sexual health in the MSM community, and, you know, HIV rates going up, syphilis, blah, 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 more risk-taking. There's a lot of focus on drugs at the moment. It seems to be the drug is the new black at the moment when it comes to reporting in the media. And so is mental health. And so The Apprentice and I have been
thinking about theorizing, it. Theorizing. Hypothesizing.
Oh, yeah. Over the past few weeks that there might be some kind of link here.
Yeah.
If people are down, feeling depressed, are they more likely to be taking risky behavior? And I think that's why we've kind of decided to do this special this week.
Exactly.
Because I from personal experience, when I was suffering, or when I was experiencing depression years ago, it was something that I was doing. I was actively very active. And, you know, and it seemed like it was this downward spiral. And I was seeking help. I did get out. And so that's kind of also what made me think, well hey, if people are actively looking after their mental health and making sure that they have a clear mind, etc., will that help in addressing some of the sexual health issues that our community is seeing? It's a huge question.
Yeah. Yes. I think there's a lot in that. If we kind of look at that connection between poor mental health and sex.
Yeah. We've got a whole hour.
Well, yeah. and there's probably material for more as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the, I guess, the connections, if we sort of make it more specific to kind of risky behavior, is that there is a connection between people who experience poor mental health and a need to try and find a way to escape from that.
And is it also a way to connect with others.
Well, and that can play a part of it as well. I mean, sex by its very nature is a pleasurable activity. Mm-hmm. And so if you are feeling, you know, depressed or down or anxious or what have you, sex is a pleasurable thing that for however long might help you to escape from that. Mm-hmm.
And Bing, I'm guessing that's what you'd be, your patients would be saying to you as well, in some manner.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also it's good to remember that when you say poor mental health, we're not only talking about people who are necessarily clinically depressed or anxious or anything like that. There are a lot of issues about self-esteem, poor body image, all that sort of stuff, which is sort of poor mental health in different forms, which I think really contributes to people's bad decisions about, you know, risk-taking and having sex.
Glenn, so you would say that high-risk sexual behaviour is very much linked to mental health?
Look, I mean, I wouldn't say that that's the case in all cases, but I do think there are a whole range of contributing factors. And mental health vulnerability would definitely be one of the contributing factors to that.
Yep.
So, I guess, as you said, not everyone who undertakes regular risk behaviour could be, you know, necessarily experiencing
poor mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. But in what ways might people what poor mental health might people be feeling that would lead them to extra risk behaviour?
Like, I think that probably some of the things that we speak about in terms of, you know, low mood, depression, Bing mentions low self-esteem. I think all of those sort of things, poor body image, all of those things are things that might lead someone to be more vulnerable or more likely to engage in some of these things. A lot of the time when people need to find an escape. It's connected with a whole range of mental health vulnerabilities, and that can be someone who is very anxious and, you know, might have difficulty finding ways to connect with people on a social level. And so one avenue that they can do that is by connecting with someone, hooking up with someone sexually. There has been research that has suggested that when people have a really low sense of their own body image, or particularly perceive themselves to be unattractive, that they're less likely to engage in safe sex practices. So all of those sorts of things can be kind of contributing factors to this.
And I'm guessing another factor in there is if you have some form of social anxiety, it may be that alcohol, for example, is a social lubricant, which then if you have a lot of social lubricant, you then go, I'm just going to go home with whoever and whatever happened, or I'll go to a sex club or whatever. Bing, is that the stories that you hear of?
Yes, I was wondering when you introduce drugs and alcohol in the picture.
We'll have time for drugs up in the next hour.
Yeah, but I agree. I think once you start adding that, it really complicates it even more, you know, and, you know, people take drugs and alcohol because of the way they feel with their mental health. And again, that will impact on their decisions about risk-taking behavior as well. But I agree with Glenn. I mean, I think not all risk-taking behavior is related to poor mental health. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people make choices. But I think if you've got mental health issues, you're more likely to make, you know, poor choices, I think.
Is screening for, so let's say we across Melbourne now, you can get rapid HIV tests, you can go and go to your GP all the time and get your standard sexual health screen. Is mental health screening a part of the standard process for a GP?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're taught to sort of screen people for mental health issues if they present with physical symptoms that might point in that direction, but it's not a standard screening you do for everyone.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I guess GPs have a lot of things to screen for.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And yeah, you've only got a certain amount of time.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It must be increasingly difficult for GPs to have the time for mental health. Is it true? For screening?
I think if, like, we're quite interested in mental health issues, so we would often offer someone to come back and do mental health issues separately. If it's something that's raised that we don't have time to actually resolve on that day, we'll ask them to come back so we can talk about it a bit more. Mm-hmm. So I think you can do that.
You are on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9 with Andrew and James. We're talking about mental health and the impacts of that on risky behaviour in regards to sex.
Yeah, if you want to add to the discussion, yes, you can. 0427 Joy 949 or on air at joy.org.au. Send us a question or some of your experiences. And yes, Dr. Bing, Ben and Dr. Glenn are here in the studio with us.
Now, Glenn, is it a case that so we're starting to talk about alcohol and drugs and how that impacts it. Do people come and see a psychologist because of alcohol and drugs first or mental health first, or is it?
Look, yeah. I mean, sometimes all of the above, sometimes one or the other. So sometimes people will come and say they're there because, or they're coming because they have a difficulty with alcohol or drugs. And sometimes, I'd probably say even often, there is one or a number of other mental health issues that are happening concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
The alcohol or drugs is often used as a way of helping them to find a temporary fix for their mood or a temporary fix for their anxiety. But from time to time, some people will present with the more sort of mental health concern, and when you question about substance use, that also emerges as something that they do. Yeah.
How easy is it to get someone to talk about their sexual behaviour as well?
Look, I think that most therapists are pretty good at questioning it, and also expecting it to be something that many people will find difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
And so there's sensitivity in the way these things are asked. But at the same time, like I mentioned earlier, it's such an important part of who we are. Mm. And just like someone who might be experiencing mood problems finds it difficult to go to work every day, they might find it difficult to have sex with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that then has implications for their relationship. And that's an important part of the equation. So, yeah.
I guess when you first start with a client, there might be one issue that you find, but then all of a sudden this hole just gets deeper and deeper, and it can lead to a myriad of things that the client had no idea that was a problem, but then all of a sudden I was like, if that's something we can fix or try and work out, then go for it.
Yeah, they're kind of, now you mention it. Yeah, you're right. I don't socialize with anyone anymore, or I don't want to have sex with my partner anymore.
Yeah. You're on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. James Phelan and Andrew the Apprentice with you, and Dr. Ben and Dr. Glenn in here, a clinical psychologist and a general practitioner, not in that order. If you want to get in touch with us, 0427 Joy 949 or on air at joy.org.au. Also, if you're wanting to find more information or talk to someone about any problems that you might have, you can give Beyond Blue a call on 1300 224636 or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Hide and Seek. Joy 94.9.
It's Happy Hump Day here on Hide and Seek, your show for exploring sex, sexuality and self. Andrew the Apprentice and James Finlay are with you. Dr. Bing, GP, and psychologist Dr. Glenn are with us, talking about Mental Health Week and the linkage between mental health and high-risk sexual behaviour.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I was interviewing someone for a feature that I'm working on at the moment, and he was telling me about his use of ice, of the drug ice, and his sexual behaviour. And we were talking about, you know, the amount that, you know, how he started using ice. It was only on weekends with his friends, and then it turned into during the week or on Thursday night, and then it just got more and more and more. And I said to him, what makes you keep going back or not stopping? And he said, I think I'm self-medicating because I'm depressed, I think, but I haven't seen anyone about it. But I'm fairly certain I'm depressed, and this is just my escape out. I'm like, okay. But then when I asked what he was doing while he was wired at night, which was he would have two nights where he got no sleep, then two nights where he got some sleep, two nights on, two nights off. Fully operational during the day. Well, depends how fully operational that is. And he said, well, I hook up with guys. I'll get on the internet or whatever app or website and find people to have sex with. Like, oh, okay. So how many years? Oh, I have about six guys a night. I said,
six guys a night.
Yeah. I said, how many? He said, six. I'm like, different people on these nights. He's like, yeah, just one after the other. And I think, well, you know, do I want to have sex with many people or do I just want to have sex with a couple of guys, but for longer? I think, well, maybe more people might be better. I said, okay. And do you feel that you have undertake different activities? I didn't want to use the word risk when you do this. And he said, well, I definitely have sex, more unprotected sex than I should.
Mm-hmm. Now, being you've done a study of people who've recently converted, had a HIV seroconversion.
Yes.
And asked about their meth use.
Yes.
And what did you find?
Well, just to give some background, it is a small study done at our clinic, and basically we're looking back at people who were diagnosed with HIV at the clinic over the last 3 years, from 2011 to 2013. And we ask about the meth use, and we compare them to other men who were coming in just for sexual health checks and having HIV tests. So we basically found that the meth use rates in the people who were diagnosed with HIV in that period were much higher than the control group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 62%, I think, said they used meth in the last 12 months, compared to the control group, which is about 33%. And that compares to our community surveys, which basically say between 9 and 14% over the last 12 months. So
even the control group's
higher risk, yeah. You know, so I think it indicates people who are coming in for sexual health checks are at higher risk anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then we asked the people who had contracted HIV and had used meth, and asked them whether they thought that their meth use was a significant cause of their HIV infection. And over the 12-month period, about 73% said that they thought it was. I mean, obviously, that's a subjective measure.
Yeah,
I think it's actually quite interesting that they think it somehow caused it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when they say cause, it's probably in a broader sense. You know, it's partly maybe, you know, higher risk practices,
mm-hmm.
more sex with more people,
mm-hmm.
just that whole behavior that James described about having days where maybe just having sex with lots of people and they're up all night having sex.
Mm.
I mean, all that would increase their risk overall, regardless of what sort of sexual practices they actually had.
Well, yeah, and I guess if, you know, we see for that many people to think that ICE might be contributing to, you know, becoming HIV positive. But then, you know, I guess some people might think that, oh, maybe it wasn't the drug. Maybe I still knew what I was doing. Sure, I may have been using it.
Yes.
I guess, you know, as you said, it could be a multiple amount of things, but still quite considerable number of people.
Yeah. Well, there's just a huge number of risk factors in those scenarios.
Yeah.
People using ICE as something that they take when they are having sex,
mm-hmm.
and therefore the, or you know, maybe it's not just confined to ICE, it's probably other drugs as well.
Sure.
But if this discussion is about ICE, it then does open that vulnerability to unsafe sex practices and mm-hmm. multiple sex partners and all of those things that Ben was just talking about, that all of that is going to increase that likelihood.
But I guess it's not the first time that people have taken drugs whilst having sex. Mm. And why do you think it's such a big issue now and not so much in the past?
I think really it's just an indication of how popular ICE is. And I think there's a whole scene with ICE use and sex that, and apps and all that that's developing. So it's quite an established scene where I have people telling me how if they don't want to use ICE for sex, sometimes it's quite awkward because it's an expectation on some of those apps that if you want to catch up for sex, you're going to use ICE. So there's that sort of culture that's developing in our community.
Wow.
So now people are worried that if they're using one of the apps to hook up, that it's expected.
So that some guys have it as a condition of hooking up, essentially. You know, come over and we're going to get wired.
Yeah. And okay. And do you think that some of this behavior could be linked to poor mental health?
I think some of the things you mentioned at the beginning and some of the stuff about, particularly about self-medicating.
Yeah,
definitely. I also think that there are habits or associations that people make. And if people get into the habit of having sex whilst using ICE, it becomes more and more difficult to have sex without using ICE.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
And then you've also got another, a vicious circle, really, where if you've got low self-esteem or poor mood, and you're trying to connect with others on an app, and the app is telling you you have to take drugs to have sex with me.
Yes.
Then you're just going around and around and around.
It's absolutely a vicious circle.
And it sort of goes in both directions. And I mean, poor mental health might cause you to use drugs or alcohol, and then but that could cause poor mental health as well.
Yeah.
It's like when James was saying about the person, you know, sort of self-medicating, but on the other hand, using ICE probably causes depression, anxiety down the track as well, so it becomes worse. So how, you know, it's chicken and egg, isn't it, which comes first?
You're on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. We're chatting with Dr. Beng and Dr. Glenn around mental health and high-risk sexual behaviour. If you've got a question, let us know, 0427-JOY-949 or email onair@joy.org.au. This is Hide and Seek during Mental Health Week. Andrew and James are with you. Dr. Beng and Dr. Glenn are with us. That's rolling off the tongue really well, guys. As you said, double activity. Here we go.
It's got legs.
It's got legs. Now, I was at a LGBTI mental health conference earlier this year, and I was somewhat surprised, and this is where some of this hypothesis that James and I started with, was there was no real discussion of sexual health or mental health at a mental health conference for our community, which I was quite surprised at. Beng, how do you think we start connecting the dots here?
I think what you're saying, though, I think it's part of the problem we're having. I think it's a very sensitive issue to talk about drugs and alcohol and our community. And I think there's a sense that we're condemning alcohol and drug use and all that in our community when we talk about it. So I think there is a slight reluctance to actually address the issues.
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know, I think our community can be quite good at discussing these things without actually condemning. And
I mean, there have been campaigns also about harm minimization. So, I mean, just I think a couple of years ago where it sort of said, you know, okay, so you went out and you got really drunk and you had these drugs, but you managed to find your way out the door. You managed to find your way into the car or to the taxi. You managed to find your way into your house, you manage to find your way to get undressed and be naked and start having sex, you've got to find a way to have a condom. Like, so if you can do all of those things, like, you know, no matter how affected you are, you
still have the ability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we maybe don't see as much of those campaigns currently, I don't know.
And I mean, today, we should also mention today is International Lesbian Day. Mm-hmm. And this week, the ALICE Project released its findings. And the ALICE Project has been a study by the University of Melbourne, Ruth McNair, around alcohol use amongst the lesbian community. And it found that 40% of lesbians in the survey, or LBQ women, lesbian, bisexual, queer women, 40% drank at harmful levels above the national recommended safe level. So it's not just the gay men, it's our female peers as well.
Yep.
And I'm guessing it's what we're getting at is the linkage needs to be explicit around mental health, alcohol and drug use, high-risk sexual behaviour and HIV risk.
Yes. I agree, and I agree with what Glenn's saying. I think a lot of what you're doing is about harm minimization. It's about talking to people about, for example, negotiating when you haven't used ICE yet and things like that, and not making all those complex decisions when you've used something.
But I guess there's no messages for this at the moment. There's, there's nothing.
No.
What do we need to do? Are we waiting for more studies? Do we need to have organizations to health organizations to take a step forward and actually be proactive in this? What do we need to do?
I think we should do more studies, but I don't think we should wait for those studies. I think it's quite clear from people who work in the area, I'm sure Glenn would agree, that this is a problem.
Yeah.
And we should address it now while waiting for more information.
I feel like a lot of people are reluctant to start something without... Or even say that something exists without having a study to back them up.
There is a big push sort of generally about everything's got to be evidence-based.
Yes.
A lot of that does come from that. But
there's a difference between having something that's evidence-based and something that's evidence-informed and having something that's evidence-informed that's a suck it and see. Trial by error. See what happens. Can we get... HIV rates down by just doing something and seeing what happens
before it's too late.
Yeah, I agree. I think we should be acting. I think we should be having new campaigns and looking at new strategies and just being creative about what we're doing rather than waiting for more information now.
Yeah, there is a lot to be said about the education of joining the dots in all of those sorts of things.
Yeah,
that there are vulnerabilities that develop for a range of reasons. Some of them are mental health. That people who use drugs and alcohol when they're having sex are more vulnerable to engaging in unsafe sex practices. I mean, those dots are fairly well established, I think. And I think that there can be stronger educations around some of those things.
Mm. And if we go back to the old analogy of there's no health unless there's mental health, it would follow that all of our health can be linked back to mental health and in many ways.
Yep, I would agree with that.
So we're wrapping up in a couple of minutes, but obviously we've been talking a lot about mental health, but do you want to just run through again some of the signs and symptoms that people might be experiencing that they should be wary of?
General mental health issues.
Yeah, general mental health issues.
I mean, I suppose the obvious ones are people who are actually feeling low moods or anxiety, sleeplessness, you know, people who can't go out socially, feel very anxious when they're out socially, just trying to think, poor appetite, fatigue. There's so many physical symptoms of mental health problems.
Mm.
They should at least consider that as a possibility and talk to a mental health person or their GP about that possibility.
And Glenn, those key ones. So what about when you are talking to someone around their alcohol and drug use? What are you looking out for?
The main thing really is how much is this impacting on a person's functioning?
Yep.
So is this something that means that they're unable to go to work? Is this something that means that they're no longer engaging with their partner? Does this actually have an impact, or is it something that is reasonably well controlled and contained? So I think that they're the sort of questions that I'm always asking and the things that I'm looking for in relation to all of that.
Yeah. So in regards to more studies, in particular, what should we be looking for?
One of the things that was lacking in terms of the HIV information was about we never used to ask about drug and alcohol use in our HIV testing, but we actually changed that.
Bizarre now that that you think about it.
It is. But they're now designing the new forms that have got a drug and alcohol use questions attached to it. And that by itself will be useful, but that's not going to give us information for, at least 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a long time to wait while we feel like there's a problem now. So I still think we should do something.
How long do these problems, with these social problems, do they come and go in waves? Like, do they sometimes stay around for a while? Is 18 months too long? Like, 18 months obviously is too long to wait to actually act on something
but
that's very current now.
But could it be something else a little bit later down the track?
Yeah.
And I know, I think if we were to look at it 5 years ago, there was the internet for hooking up, but there weren't apps.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
There wasn't social media. We kind of do know that, those things are contributing to a lot of these problems.
Do you think apps have actually changed the way that... obviously, it's changed the way that people hooked up, but how about the way that people think and people's mental health? Has that... Do you think it's added anxiety or added a sense of... there must be something better.
Well, I mean, the reality of an app is that in the past, if someone wanted to access one of those services, they had to sit down at a computer and log into their profile and sit in that environment for a period of time. Mm-hmm. With an app, you can be doing it on the tram, you can be doing it at work, you know, you can do it all wherever you are.
Yeah.
And so that means people use it a lot more. Mm-hmm. It means that it can have a much bigger impact. Yeah, and, you know, that, I guess that's what we see.
And it can both positive and negative. I mean, positive in that it does, yes, it does connect people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But in the negative, in that, particularly if you're getting rejected or anything like that,
yes,
there's a whole other issue there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
James,
yes.
We should say thank you to Dr. Beng and Dr. Glenn.
Yes, thank you for coming in. And of course, as we mentioned, if you feel like that you need to talk to someone about issues that you're having, you can. Beyond Blue is available on 1300 22 4636 and Lifeline on 13 11 14.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.